Thank you all for being here together, supporting each other in our practice. At a time when there are no words to contain the pain, fear, the anguish, and the heartbreak, it's important to have this silent sitting practice in which we can experience the spaciousness of awareness that is vast and large enough to contain everything we think and feel. And it's also important to make use of words and language to help us connect with each other, even if in disagreement, and to help us reflect and connect with the present moment that feels unbearable, and to connect with experiences that we as humans have survived and overcome before. So particularly when I read this week's Torah portion, the story of Noah, I recognize a pattern in human history and in the history of the natural world that may help us to contain our current experience in the vast and spacious perspective of human history and beyond. In Parsha Noah this week, a particular theme leaped out for me. We see God struggling with the problem of creating a world which gets entirely out of God's control. God's beautiful project has, for the first, second, and third time in the beginning, that's only the beginning, turned out not as God expected or planned. We can certainly relate to this. We've all launched projects with the best of intentions, the most beautiful of plans, and after an inspiring launch, things sometimes did not go as planned. The project, the creation, seemed to have a mind of its own, and it was not you, the creator. It's not what you, the creator, had in mind. Of course, anyone who grows up in a family understands this. We no sooner get the idea to have children than the process goes entirely out of our control. We no sooner get the idea to form a relationship than it doesn't go as planned. We can't plan when a child will be born, and if we have a child, the child certainly will not be exactly as we planned. And in the story of Genesis, and again in Parsha Noah, God has a plan and the same problem. In an act of amazing beauty and creativity, with incredible order, God creates a world out of chaos. It's a paradise for Adam and Eve. Should God have known that this human that God just created would be tempted to eat from the very tree God prohibited humans from eating? God seemed not to understand the very basic properties of complex systems. Today, systems theory helps us understand that in a complex system consisting of many parts, like God's creation consisted of many parts, that these parts tend to self-organize. What happens in a system can no longer be predicted based on the property of each element, properties of each element in isolation. For example, knowing about me and my behavior will not predict how I will function in one group of people or another, because each group will self-organize in ways that will influence my behavior. And all that will depend on what's happening outside of the group, but influencing the group in the present moment. What happens will depend on how the system, the whole system, interacts, and not on entirely on how each person would act as if they were on their own. Often we organize in ways that are helpful, like in this group. Many people say, I can sit and meditate only with a group, even if the group is just on Zoom. That's because we are different when we are influenced by being part of a group or system than when we are alone. When we step back and look at what we have learned in the science of systems and complexity theory, we recognize the same underlying truth that our meditation teachers have taught through the ages. That no self has a separate, solid, independent identity. We are all influencing each other and influenced by the innumerable complex interactions of our molecules, our cells, our organs, our bodies, and our minds within and between ourselves and the rest of all creation. There is no separate self we can identify. And we have all seen ways in which systems that were started with good intentions turn out doing things that are destructive, things that could not have been predicted on the basis of the individual behavior or intentions of each person. Though in retrospect, often we come up with explanations that make us think, well, this was perfectly obvious. Why didn't anybody recognize this before? But that has to do with errors in our thinking that we can discuss at another time. And so it was in the Garden of Eden. God told Adam not to eat from the tree of knowledge. Of course, any experienced parent or teacher will know that the proverbial forbidden fruit becomes more coveted than all the things that are offered freely. That might have been the first mistake, but then an unanticipated alliance develops. The serpent promises Eve that if she eats of this fruit, her eyes will be open. The serpent says, but God knows that as soon as you eat of it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like divine beings who know good and bad. God had never reached out to Eve personally to explain why life would be better without eating the fruit. And the serpent cleverly represents God and the divine beings to Eve as having something wonderful that they don't want Eve to have. Eve forms an alliance with the serpent, who has cleverly planted a seed of doubt, mistrust, and a longing to have something that others have, that she doesn't have. This was not God's plan, but as a result, this perfectly crafted Garden of Eden is lost to humans who are driven out to live a life of toil, hardship, and to experience the pain of childbirth. So God sees that God's plan did not work out as expected, and humans start over again in a new setting. And once again, God does not anticipate the impact of the interactions between Cain and Abel. God does not take into account that these complex creatures, full of longing to be loved, that desire to be loved, and also capable of retaliation when this feeling is not fulfilled, could act in such ways. God does not pay heed to Cain's sacrifice, but pays heed only to Abel's sacrifice. God has not anticipated that Cain's jealousy will become so intense that he will strike down Abel. Each individual is a complex system of loving and hateful, retaliatory feelings and impulses, able to respond and react in ways that are beyond God's control. Their interactions are complex and multiply the possibilities. So we fast forward several generations to Parsha Noah, and the complexity of the system is entirely out of God's control. It's hopeless. God created humans with a capacity for loving, inevitably connected with the capacity for longing, which leads, of course, to humans wanting things we can't have. This longing, unrestrained by clear guidelines or strong practices, will lead to corruption, grabbing, stealing, killing. And so, in Parsha Noah, God says to Noah, I have decided to put an end to all flesh, for the earth is filled with lawlessness because of them. I am about to destroy them with the earth. So in the plan to start over, Noah is chosen because Noah is, for his time, pretty understanding and trustworthy, and indeed follows the instructions to build the ark, to save the creatures, to wait, and to be patient for a very long time. And when the flood finally receded and God liberated Noah's family and all the animals to repopulate the earth, Noah built an ark to Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, and taking of every pure animal and every pure bird, he offered burnt sacrifices on the altar. And God smelled the pleasing odor and resolved, never again will I doom the earth because of mankind. Since the devising of mankind, of the human mind, are evil from youth, nor will I ever again destroy every living being as I have done. And the rainbow is set in the sky as a sign of the covenant. But no sooner has this promise been made than the interactions of humans and their grasping after things again leads to misconduct. Noah learns how to make wine, gets drunk, and one of his sons takes advantage of his father's vulnerability in what is vaguely described as a sexual assault. God, unfortunately, had not learned a lesson in the interaction between Cain and Abel, and God curses Ham's descendants, setting up once more a seed for hatred, jealousy, and strife. And the Parsha ends with the Tower of Babel. By this time, God has recognized the potential of these humans who have been created with the capacity for creativity, ingenuity, and productivity. In the story, God says to God's self, if as one people with one language for all, this is how they have begun to act, then nothing that they may propose to do will be out of their reach. One could read that as an incredibly hopeful or terrible thing. God seems to perceive this as a threat, although one could read that as a kind of hopeful idea that if people could work together and communicate freely, there would be nothing beyond our reach, perhaps including peace. So God gives everyone a different language, or, you know, creates different languages so that people cannot be united. People are scattered over the face of the earth. These stories of starting over after the expulsion from paradise, the flood, the Tower of Babel, are descriptive of a pattern that begins with hopeful, beautiful, creative energy and at some point is disrupted or destroyed by forces of greed. We often ask why God would create a world with evil. If we understand the Torah is descriptive rather than prescriptive, as Yocheved often teaches, we can see ourselves as humans in this pattern of exuberant beginnings and flourishing until somehow within this process the seeds of destruction begin to grow, leading to devastating loss. And indeed, most religious traditions have us enact and embody this cycle of abundance and deprivation, exuberance and restraint over the course of each year. The fullness of summer is followed by Tisha B'Av, a time of destruction. We are comforted and redeemed with Rosh Hashanah, the rebirth of the new year, chastened by 10 days of repentance, from which we emerge into the abundance of Sukkot. Purim, our holiday of excess, is followed by Passover, a time of restriction and restraint. In the Catholic tradition, the theme of Fat Tuesday or Mardi Gras, a time of excess, is followed by Lent, a time of restriction. Eastern traditions give us a now familiar symbol of how everything that is creative also includes the seeds of demise, the crumbling of the walls, the breakdown of old institutions, which can also make for new beginnings. While we take a step back and look at historical trends, even including the great geological trends and the five great extinctions that have unfolded on this earth since the beginning, when we take a step back, we can feel an acceptance of our teeny tiny role in this big picture and the necessity of loss in order for change to happen. I emphasize this theoretical acceptance, since most of us probably feel, well, if I look at the five great extinctions of the different species over the history of geological time on Earth, I accept, theoretically, that things have to break down, suffer destruction, in order for new life and new growth to arise. But then there immediately rises in us a feeling, a thought, I just don't want to be there when it happens. I don't want it to happen to me or anyone I love. And here, our own seeds of grasping rise up out of our exuberance for life. This is the yin-yang image that our exuberance for life, within that is contained the grasping and longing to be alive and enjoy this wonderful life. And within that are also seeds of aggression and destruction. And without the Ten Commandments, the Eightfold Path, the practices and restraints that keep us in line, these seeds of destruction threaten our survival. So it's not surprising that Eastern traditions focus on meditation practice as a way to become liberated from the compulsions of greed and grasping, or its opposite, aversion, which again, you could see as part of the same thing. In our greed or grasping, we're simultaneously pushing away something else. So as we sit in silence, we can see in ourselves the waves of creativity and exuberance, and the seeds of greed and grasping, even within those positive forces. Can our practice help us to see these impulses as they arise, to watch them as they distort our thinking and planning, not to mention as they drive our behavior? Can we embody our creative impulses and also observe the impulse to grab more than we need? I'm not offering this as any kind of political agenda or historical commentary, but only as a way we can reflect on our moment-to-moment personal interactions, the moments when we feel expansive and the moments when we feel something tighten inside us and put us on guard. When do these impulses lead to healthy, self-protective behaviors? And when do they give a message that is hostile and unintentionally provocative toward others?